And welcome back to Thursday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. Joseph Cooper is still recovering from a severe back injury, and we do hope to have him back with us very soon. Well, doesn't it often seem that as soon as we surmount one obstacle to progress, another one pops up in its place? Why are some people able to triumph amid seemingly impossible situations or circumstances while others are not? And is facing obstacles and moving through them something anyone can learn? Or are some people just endowed with special capabilities? Today we visit with someone who's overcome an array of his own obstacles to become a best-selling author, media strategist, marketing director, and editor-at-large for the New York Observer. Ryan Holiday's latest book is The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. Okay, and he joins us, I think, from Washington, D.C. Is that right, Ryan?
It is. It's good to be here.
Great to have you with us. We appreciate it. So you go back to the ancients for the basis of your book. It's based on the philosophy of Stoicism. What did the Stoics believe and what did they practice?
Sure. So I define Stoicism as a practical philosophy as opposed to a theoretical philosophy. It's about ethics and a framework for dealing with an inherently unpredictable world. The most prominent Stoic that most people have probably heard of is the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. And my book was inspired by a book that he wrote almost 2,000 years ago, which I think is a totally unique historical document. You have the most powerful man in the world writing notes to himself about how to be a better person and to deal with the responsibilities of his office. And so I sort of take that and see how we can apply it in our own lives, because hopefully our problems are a little less severe than those of the most powerful man in the world.
You're talking about the meditations.
I am, yes.
Okay, I don't want to appear ageist, and I'm not, but you're really young. So how and when did you come to embrace Stoicism and Marcus Aurelius, or is it a resurgence that I'm unaware of?
I think it's both. So I was introduced to Stoicism, I believe I was 18 years old, and I was sort of, I realize now it was part of a long tradition of successful people discovering the Stoic works, specifically a work like Meditations, and handing it to someone else who thought that it would benefit them and that they could learn from it. Although I do think this is, I think when you look at history, you see Stoicism make a resurgence during tumultuous times. You know, George Washington put on a play about Cato, the Roman Stoic, at Valley Forge. You saw James Stockdale use Stoicism in the prison camps of Vietnam. You see it in the Renaissance. You see it in the Victorian era. You see it in the Civil War. You see it, and now increasingly you see it in the Silicon Valley with entrepreneurs, because it's this idea of, look, the world is unpredictable. The world can be chaotic and very uncertain, but what we do control is our response to that world and to those obstacles that we face.
So it's important to know what we can and can't control.
Sure, yeah, and that's another sort of modern tie to Stoicism, the serenity prayer that is practiced in 12-step groups all over the world, is sort of Stoicism embodied. It's this idea of making the distinction between the things that are in your power and the things that are not in your power, and focusing your energies exclusively on the ones that are.
Well, do you think things are a little more difficult at this time because we have so much knowledge and technology and resources that maybe with all those advantages, we might get a false sense that we can control more than we actually do?
Oh, I think that's absolutely correct. I was talking to someone the other day. I think what's so interesting about the response to the crash of the Malaysian flight.
Exactly.
It's almost that it's offensive to it. Obviously, it's a tragedy, and it's terrible for the families involved, but it seems almost offensive to everyone else that a plane could simply disappear
right.
In 2014. And you only have to go back, not that far in history, to see that this was, not only a much more common experience, but death and unexpectedness and completely inexplicable events sort of part of the human experience, but I think we lose that when technology can make our expectations for the world go a little askew.
Well, let's talk a little about you and your own experiences with adversity. and how you surmounted them. I mean, it looks like you dropped out at two crucial moments in your life. Do you think that's because you were so... First, why don't you talk about those moments?
Sure. Well, I guess what I would say is I'm not in the book, right? Stoicism is something that I've used in my own life that's crucial to who I am and what I've done. But I wanted the book to be about history and sort of timeless, inarguable examples, because right. I think obviously other people have gone through far more serious adversity than I have, being a white male in America in 2014, right? But, you know, I dropped out of college when I was 19 years old, and Stoicism was what I turned to when, you know, my parents freaked out and disowned me, and, like, things didn't immediately go as well as I thought. Stoicism was the sort of the discipline and the exercise that I turned to calm myself down, to manage the sort of the fear and the frustration and the uncertainty that comes along with making any sort of big decision. And then, you know, I've written 3 books now, and I've managed a number of employees, and I've started my own businesses. These are stressful enterprises, to say the least, and Stoicism is a framework for managing that responsibility and managing it in a way that it doesn't take over your life, that your priorities don't run amok, and you're sort of focusing on what's important and the tasks that you have in front of you.
Well, let's talk about overcoming the fear of taking the risks. I mean, you took certain risks in your life at certain crucial moments. How does one do that?
Yeah, I think what the Stoics would say is putting that risk in perspective, right? Other people would be, like, when I dropped out of college, there's probably billions of people all over the world who would have instantly traded, you know, positions with me in a heartbeat, because what I thought was stressful and fearful would have been someone else's, you know, wildest fantasy, right? And then it's also thinking about, like, why am I so afraid? Is this because I'm actually in danger and it actually is risky, or is this somewhat of a outdated biological response to sort of stress in general? And I talk about this in the book, like, mm-hmm. you know, we get fight or flight reflexes all the time in our lives today over emails and traffic and all sorts of things that are, you know, not nearly as serious as being attacked by a lion or something.
No, not quite. So we need to understand the difference between emotional reactions and rational reactions. So you say we need to choose our course of action from the rational response. So how do we turn these lessons into taking that action?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that prevents people from taking action is this sort of expecting or demanding perfection from themselves. So I saw, when I dropped out of college, I was actually, even though it was scary, it was actually really great for me, because I saw the rest of my class graduate into the financial recession and sort of immediately do one of two things, right? Either go, oh man, this is a terrible job market, I'm going to go back to school, or I'm going to move back home with mom and dad. But I didn't have that option. So the idea that this was not an ideal, you know, economic time to be operating without a degree, like that maybe I made a mistake, it's like I already burned the bridge, right? Or I already burned the boats behind me. Now I had to sort of make my way. And I think, you know, I tell the story of Amelia Earhart in the book, who, you know, is this amazing female aviator, but her first flight was nothing glamorous or dramatic. They forced her to go with a male chaperone and didn't pay her. But it's this idea of doing what it takes to get started and creating momentum from there, rather than waiting for what is perceived to be some ideal starting point.
So you're talking about, you say that perfection leads to paralysis. So as in the case of her first flight, it wasn't a perfect situation, but she took it.
Right. And she made the most of it once she took it. And she knew that if they would just give her a shot, she would be able to sort of take it from there.
Do you think we can all learn to use these obstacles to our advantage? I mean, you talk about Abraham Lincoln and Dr. Martin Luther King, Thomas Edison, the list goes on, even Steve Jobs. We always think of them as possessing some extraordinary gift. Are you saying we all have the capacity for greatness, or just that we can all use obstacles to our advantage?
Yeah, well, look, one of the people I talk a lot about in the book, sort of a personal hero of mine, is Ulysses S. Grant. And Ulysses S. Grant was a total failure up until the Civil War, right? So I think the idea that these people were sort of endowed with some genetic greatness, I think, is beside the point. And I think especially the ones who explicitly followed Stoicism, they credit the philosophy with being the reason they were able to do these things. But I think the answer to that question is, if Dwight D. Eisenhower is able to see in the onslaught of 200,000 German troops a slight opportunity that he turns into the Battle of the Bulge and then essentially victory in World War II, mm-hmm. he's able to turn that into account. When the PowerPoint presentation doesn't work, or a colleague starts, acting really strange and jealous around you, or the company you're working for goes out of business, or any of the things, the more likely day-to-day adversity that we face,
right.
I think it's much more likely that we'll be able to find benefit from one of those things than these great men and women throughout history have managed to wring from much more serious things.
We're speaking with Ryan Holiday. He's a media strategist. He's a prominent writer on strategy and business. He's currently editor-at-large for the New York Observer. And are you still director of marketing at American Apparel?
Yeah, I'm more, I don't have a day-to-day role there anymore, but I consult on all the marketing stuff, and I spend about a week a month there.
Oh, okay. Well, his first best-selling book was Trust Me, I'm Lying, Confessions of a Media Manipulator, which I'd like to talk about a little too. But we're discussing his latest book, The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. And we're going to take a short break. We'll come back and maybe talk about some of your obstacles. Stay with us. And welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. And we're visiting with Ryan Holiday. His latest book is The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. Perhaps you have done that yourself, maybe even using the Stoic philosophy. Or perhaps you'd like to talk to Ryan. You can call us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. Ryan, I'm thinking, how do we recognize when an obstacle is so formidable in reality that it would be unrealistic to persist? How do we know, differentiate between those things that are impossible, like I'm going to be a concert pianist and go after it, I'm just going to hang in there until I can get there, or the things that really are possible?
Yeah, sure. And it's definitely a difficult thing to discern, and it's something I struggled with in the book. Like, on the one hand, I tell the story of Demosthenes, the great Athenian orator, who overcame a speech impediment and became the sort of the voice of Athens. Then on the other hand, you have someone like Thomas Jefferson, who similarly had a speech impediment and said, okay, I'm going to do very little public speaking, and instead I'm going to become this sort of great writer. And so I think it's more about making that call on a case-by-case basis. But it's really interesting when you read the Stoics that this idea of acquiescence or acceptance is very crucial, and it comes up over and over again. It's about sort of seeing the things that are bigger than us, accepting that things are going to happen to us that we can't do something about, and instead focusing on how we can make the most of that situation. So I guess an analogy might be like, look, if you're driving down the road and it turns out it's blocked for construction, you take the detour. You don't park your car and get out and start yelling about it.
Right. Which one could do in South Florida?
Sure.
Okay, and give us some more examples.
Of acceptance?
Of acceptance.
Yeah, so I think one of the most powerful concepts in Stoicism is this idea of amor fati, which means in Latin a love of fate. And I tell the story of Thomas Edison in the book. He's 67 years old. He's eating dinner, and they rush in, and his factory is literally on fire. So he rushes to the scene. It's this almost stunningly beautiful fire in a weird way, because he's got all these weird chemicals there. So it's multiple stories in red and green and blue flames. And Edison's reaction, I think, is so magnificent. He tells his son, he says, go get your mother and all her friends. We'll never see a fire like this again. Which is so stunning to me, because here's his life work, and it's literally burning up, and he is actually enjoying the scene. And he tells a reporter the next day, like, hey, I've been through this before. It prevents a man from being inflicted with ennui. And in fact, it actually invigorates him. He makes more money that year than he was on track to make. He takes $1 million loan from Henry Ford to rebuild the factory. And so it's just something that I think about, you know, when Microsoft Word eats the document that I've been working on. You know, am I gonna get mad and quit, or am I gonna say, okay, this is a chance for me to redo something that wasn't as good as it could have been in the first place?
If you'd like to talk about an obstacle you're facing right now in your life and perhaps the stoic approach to getting through it with Ryan Holiday, you are welcome to call. The number is 1-800-743-9576. Not that he's an advisor, but maybe he has a few words of some kind of advice. 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. radio@wlrn.org. I was reading your blog, and you say there's no question that self-education's never been easier, but there's a dark side to this glut of free information. It's enabled a whole industry of self-help gurus, life coaches, social media marketers to sell snake oil to the masses, tricking people who genuinely want to improve their lives. And it goes on. And I'm just wondering how your book and your blog, for that matter, differ from the usual, like a self-help guide. What are you doing that's different?
Yeah, well, what I love about Stoicism is that Stoicism is a practical philosophy by people who have done things. It's CEOs, it's writers, it's entrepreneurs, it's soldiers, it's statesmen, and, you know, the two most prominent Stoics, you have Marcus Aurelius, who's the emperor of Rome, and then on the other hand, you have Epictetus, who is a former slave, who was banished by a previous emperor. And so, to me, Stoicism is not... It is not feel good, you know, puffery. It's not, you know, directionless hope. It is a real framework to tackle the actual problems in your life. And the way that it's told is through stories from people who have applied this exact thing. And what I was talking about in that article is how it can become very easy to pursue knowledge for its own sake, when knowledge is free and so easily accessible.
Right.
And what actually matters is testing this in the real world. I quote, you know, Theodore Roosevelt in the book, where he's saying, you know, what's needed more than genius is a cool head under pressure, and you can only get that by practice. And so I'm talking about, you know, it's great to learn things or to take free courses from MIT or Yale on the internet, but if you're not putting yourself in a position to actually enact those strategies and learn and get real-world feedback from them, at what point does it just, you know, become self-gratification?
Well, I think so many people, you know, these things resonate with them. They read these things and they resonate with them, or it resonates with them, but they just have fear that prevents them from taking that action.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And what I like about Stoicism is that it's so simple. Stoicism is not some exclusive philosophy that you have to, you know, buy into. It's a set of exercises that have been accumulated over thousands of years that you can apply. And it's like, hey, there, you know, is this in my control or is this not in my control? And ask yourself the next time you face something that you're upset about, or this. There is a great line from the Stoics, there is no good or bad, there is only perception. And these are just like little reminders that obviously are easier said than done, but they get better and you can use them more the more you sort of practice them. And so I just see Stoicism as it's practical aphorisms, essentially. And sometimes that can be the best way to, you know, teach someone an idea that can change their life.
Let's talk to James in Delray Beach. Hi, James. Welcome to Topical Currents.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Absolutely interesting interview, and it's very germane to the way I live my life today. But the question I have for you is that, is it, you know, is Stoicism a natural, like, inherited genetic kind of thing? Because it seems to, appear all over the course of history through all different socioeconomic classes, but in my experience in day-to-day life, it is so widely not practiced. So, you know, does it exist in some sort of normal state in certain humans, or, you know what I mean? It's interesting how it arrives in some people and not in others.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting idea. One, I think it's interesting how Stoicism is this sort of hidden hand operating behind the scenes on a lot of successful people. Like, you know, Bill Clinton reads the Meditations every year, but most people don't know that. It's sort of just been lost to history because it's not as exciting for college professors to talk about than like Kant or Aristotle or something, right? Do some people have adversity early on in life that hardens them in a way that makes it appear much more natural? Sure. But I think what Stoicism is at its best is a set of reminders or, again, exercises that you practice. And they're well within everyone's reach. And the more you do it, the more within your reach it is. I would love to see more people do it.
That's an excellent answer. The greater understanding of it for me is that, you know, on a deeper level, is that it seems that Stoicism is so counterproductive to this consumer-based economy we live in, because so many people react, and it's almost like that invisible hand is pushing a lot of times away from people to use acceptance as a solution and more to find something outside of yourself to seek relief. You know, so it's almost like society's working against that philosophy in general today.
Well, I don't know if it's just society. It might be our own destructive impulses that are inherent within everyone, just like some of the good parts in Stoicism. So when you see someone like Marcus Aurelius reminding himself how, you know, you don't get to take fame or money with you when you die, to me that's a very relevant thing to be thinking about now. You know, you can earn and earn and earn, but what he wants to remind, he says, I think most poignantly, he says, you know, Alexander the Great and his mule driver the same thing happened to both, and they were buried next to each other in the same earth.
Mm-hmm.
And to
me,
that's a very humbling idea, you know, when I see a fancy car or, you know, the potential to make a lot of money comes up. It's not that these things are meaningless and you shouldn't have them. It's that you've got to sort of put them in their proper perspective.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for taking my call.
Okay, thank you, James.
Bye-bye.
Well, Ryan, we don't have long. I just want to point out that the book is very readable. It's broken into three parts: perception, action, and will. And there are a lot of good lessons and a lot of great examples in each of the sections. So it's called The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph. And I believe your website is ryanholiday.net.
Yes.
And if you could, just in about 30 seconds, what your first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, is so different from this one. Where was the bridge?
Yeah, so my first book is an expose, warts and all, of the modern media system, and in a lot of ways my own participation in some of the worst of it. For me, it was actually weird. Like, I've been writing about Stoicism since I was a teenager, so for my audience, the first book was a surprise. Originally, they were like, oh, I thought you were going to write a book about philosophy. So was the book I always wanted to write. Trust Me, I'm Lying came first because it was a moment in time that I wanted to capture.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and we appreciate you being with us. Ryan Holiday, media strategist. He's the editor-at-large for the New York Observer and still a director of marketing at American Apparel, and his latest book is The Obstacle is the Way, The Timeless Art of Turning Trials into Triumph, and we'll have a link to it on our website. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Bye-bye. And Food and Dining is next. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, and regrettably, Joseph Cooper still recovering from a back injury. Well, is there anyone who doesn't like fried food?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Some of us do our best to avoid it, while others seem to give in more readily to the urge to indulge. And what would you consider the ultimate fried comfort food? Joining us now is Cordon Bleu chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend, Linda Gassenheimer.
So nice to be friends with you, Bonnie. Can always depend on you.
Welcome, Linda. How are you?
Nice to be here.
Good.
Okay, fried chicken. And America's number one comfort food is getting star treatment. And it's getting the star treatment from the master planner of the South Beach Wine and Food Festival, Lee Schrager. Lee Schrager, I was surprised, considering that the festival features some of the finest wines and foods in the world, that he was writing a fried chicken book. Mm. But his new book, it's called Fried and True, More Than 50 Recipes for America's Best Fried Chicken and Sides. And he's here to give us some tips on making perfect fried chicken at home. Let's welcome Lee Schrager.
Good afternoon, ladies. Good afternoon.
Nice to have you with us.
Likewise.
And we'd love to have you, our listeners, join us. What is your favorite fried chicken? Or do you have any questions for Lee Schrager? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. WLRN. And email?
Email is radio at WLRN.org, and you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
Also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and he gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns in the Miami Herald. And you can also read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, first I want to say hi to Lee. Nice to be with you.
Fred,
and
nice
I'm going to
you.
Talk about the kinds of wines that I think would go in fried chicken and then maybe ask Lee for some of his opinions.
Okay, sounds good. Lee, are you ready for that?
I'm ready.
All right. Okay, Lee Schrager, fried chicken. Why an entire book devoted to it?
Well, interestingly enough, as I got into it, I found out that there really had never been a book on fried chicken, a book totally dedicated.
A whole book. Did you think maybe there was a reason?
No, I never thought. I just thought that there was a need, after doing some research. And I think what we found is that it's really, like you said, America's number one favorite iconic comfort food. And that everybody, whether it was a white tablecloth chef like a Jean-Georges or a Daniel Ballou or Andrew Carmelini, or great chefs that no one ever heard of, great cooks that no one ever heard of, along shacks along the side of the street, had a great fried chicken story.
Well, obviously, you were right to write it because you told me before the show that it's just flying off the shelves.
We couldn't be more pleased with the success. Nothing says summer like fried chicken, school out, watermelon, and it was good timing to get a book on fried chicken.
Well, congratulations to that. So you traveled all over the U.S. gathering recipes instead of just having the chefs, which you could easily do, have them just send you their recipes. Why was the road trip so important to you?
I think we wanted to hear the stories. I think one thing that we learned, in speaking and doing a lot of the legwork in writing the book was that everybody had a story, whether it was Thomas Keller, whether it was somebody on the side of the street in Alabama. Everybody had a story about where their recipe came from, whether it was passed on from a relative, whether it was something, a recipe they learned how to cook early on in their career, whether it was something that their mom taught them how to cook. Every story, every recipe had a story that came together.
Well, that's so, and I want to hear some of those stories. And you mentioned somebody like Thomas Keller from the French Laundry, where it's $300 a person, major white tablecloth restaurant. And also in the book, you have something from something like Prince's Hot Chicken Shack. So from the shack to the world famous, what were some of your favorite stories? What were some of these people like?
We probably visited over 200 restaurants in writing this book and ended up with...
I want to know if you ate at all of them.
Every one of them.
For sure. How long did this take you?
We were on a road trip last June and July. Uh-huh. And then we'd done some work beforehand and some work that came in after it. But every recipe in this book, everyone except the... Yotam Ottolenghi, we did not go to London to try his schnitzel that's in the book, but when he did our New York City Wine and Food Festival last year, he prepared it for us and we shot it there. So there's not a recipe in the book that we did not try in its venue, except for the Yotam Ottolenghi recipe, and that we didn't reproduce many times to make sure that it was accessible for the home cook. That was really important for us, that all the recipes be available
for the
home
cook. So I want to ask you, how did you test these recipes? Did you have other people testing them, or how did you go about it?
Once we received the recipe, we tested them together, whether it was in my kitchen out last summer in the Hamptons or in New York City in my apartment, or when we were finally ready to shoot the book in the professional photography studio. But every recipe was tested at least 3 times before it went into the book for adjustments. You know, chefs are, some of these chefs are not chefs. Some of them are simple home cooks with some of the best recipes who really kind of, it was more a pinch of this and a touch of that. And it was really important that we made sure that there were no problems with the recipes, because there's nothing more disappointing for someone than to be making dinner for their family or a friend and the recipe's wrong.
Did the best recipes always come from the South? I mean, we think of the South as being the home of, you know, fried chicken.
Well, you are 100% wrong. And like like myself.
That makes you feel good, Bonnie.
Yes, Bonnie. You took away. I would have asked you, where do you think fried chicken came from? So, Linda, where does fried chicken come from?
Oh, well.
What would you have said, Linda?
What would I have said?
What would you have said?
I don't know.
Well, clearly, as I jokingly, I was playing with Bonnie, and she did not get my book yet, but I'll make sure she gets it. And Linda,
is in your book, and I read it.
It is in my book.
Yes.
So
but I don't remember it.
Well, it's the most obscure place that you'd think fried chicken would come from.
Is it? Oh, it's the most obscure place?
Well, not obscure, just you wouldn't think fried chicken coming from there.
I was going to say London, but never mind.
No.
No, London's dreary. Scotland's obscure.
Scotland.
The first early reportings of fried chicken.
Aha! But it was British, so I was almost right.
You were somewhat right.
Yes. Thank you.
You were somewhat right.
I knew it was up there somewhere.
In the same area, exactly.
Why Scotland?
That I can't answer. I can't tell you why it came from Scotland. I can tell you that the earliest reportings of fried chicken came from Scotland in the 1700s, then made its way over to the States and ended up in the Deep South. And the slaves really are the people who put their own interpretations on it. They would make it for their masters or for their families and sell it. A lot of them sold it. And it's, you know, that's why the beauty of fried chicken is that everyone thinks it's such an iconic food from the South, but it is not. It is definitely from Scotland.
Well, you know, you mentioning that we always think it's from the South, and what I thought was so fascinating in your book, by the way, Fried and True, I think that's a great title.
Yeah, that is a great title.
It's a really terrific title. You have versions from Indian and Asian, even gluten. You even have a gluten-free one. I noticed you have a recipe from Hai Vong. Hai Vong's a delightful little Vietnamese restaurant.
Hole in the wall, right here on Southwest 8th Street in Miami.
Right. And her recipe is so simple. Tell us what makes her recipe so good. There's almost nothing in it. I mean,
maybe that's what makes it so good. Sometimes it's a simplicity. I mean, there are restaurants that have 27 ingredients in it, and they're great. There are restaurants that have two ingredients in it, and they're great. In the sense of Hai Vong, it's really the oil that you're using and the seasoning. I mean, it's very, very, very lightly dipped in flour. There's no dredge in it. I mean, there's no wash in it. So it's really a half a chicken that's dredged very quickly in flour, then fried in wonderful sesame oil.
Ah, that's so you really, get that. And can you bring sesame oil up to that temperature? Because it's
yes,
it's
you
different.
Can. Absolutely, it fries up. And one of the most important things to do in frying is to make sure you're frying at the right temperature. Probably the greatest tip that I can give any of your listeners is to fry at that 370 degrees. Make sure your oil starts at 370.
So, well, give us some more tips if we want to make the perfect fried chicken at home.
Well, I think there are a lot of different tips, and some of my favorites are, you know, brining or not to brine. That is the question, to brine or not to brine. And
some people may not know what brine is.
Brining is really nothing more than tenderizing a product. It could be marinating it. It could be dipping it in a salt water solution. It could be marinating in fresh herbs and spices overnight. You could marinate for an hour, or you could brine for an hour or two, or some of the recipes called for 12
Doesn't
hours.
Doesn't it make it very salty?
Well, I'd have to say that depending on which recipe you're using, it could make it salty. But ultimately, if you take a kosher chicken, which is, you know, if you don't have time to brine, use a kosher chicken.
I noticed that tip in your book. I thought it was interesting. Because they kosher it with salt.
Right. Exactly. It's koshered with salt. So that makes a big difference. And so if you don't have time to brine, use a kosher chicken. And you don't have to brine at all. I will tell you, some recipes you can take a big taste, a big difference if you've brined the chicken beforehand. Others you really can't. So I think the key ingredient in fried chicken, as you'll see in Fried and True, is really the oil that you're using.
Fred, did you want to add something?
I was just wondering when that fried chicken was invented in Scotland. Do you know about when it happened?
The 1700s.
1700s. Yep. So it's only been around for that long.
It's been around since the 1700s, exactly.
Wow.
That we know of.
That we know of course. right. That's been recorded. The earliest recordings of fried chicken.
Okay, so you were mentioning some tips. What about, what do you fry it in if you don't have a professional fryer, an electric fryer or something? What are some
cast iron. I mean, there's nothing, not only does it look good, it smells good, it's authentic. I mean, cast iron is, I couldn't think of frying in anything other than cast
iron. A shallow pan?
No, I mean, a cast iron, some of them are, you know, are quite high.
Everyone, this is not television.
Right. Sorry.
He's showing us his hand,
no,
I'd say 5 inches.
You know, cast iron can be as high as 4 inches, 5, 6 inches high. Right. So, yeah. I mean, when you're frying, you need to have the oil covering the chicken.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, that's the important thing. When you're deep frying, there's a large quantity of oil. When you're frying in a skillet, it's just enough chicken to cover the top of the chicken in the skillet. But I think the skillet is the best way and easiest way to fry.
Well, that's interesting because I would have thought of a deep saucepan.
No. I think it's, I love the skillet. I love the cast iron skillet. I think it's adds a certain taste to it.
Do you reuse the oil?
I do, certainly. Uh-huh. You know, I think, again, the key to ingredient with the oil is the temperature. So if you're going to reuse it, if you're going to make a few batches in the same day, make sure that, you know, once you clean it, if you're going to clean the oil, which you can do or you don't have to do, is to get the temperature back up to that 370.
When you were talking about the Vietnamese restaurant and you said the oil, were you talking about a type of oil that
sesame.
They use?
Sesame. They use a sesame oil. It's highly seasoned already. What's so wonderful about the Hai Vong is it's cooked in this hot, it's probably higher than 370 degrees, and they finish it with peppers and wonderful scallions on top. And it's really one of the best things out there. And I think it's $10.95 in the menu. We had it on Sunday night.
We're drooling and hungry and sending everybody out to get some Hai Vong fried chicken, we need to take a small break here.
Great.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking fried chicken with Lee Schrager. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Lee Schrager. He's the founder of the South Beach and New York Wine and Food Festival. His latest book is Fried and True, More Than 50 Recipes for America's Best Fried Chicken and Sides. And he's been giving us tips on how to make the perfect fried chicken at home and taking us on a tour of America's favorite country foods. On another note, please mark your calendars for June 17th for the annual Share Our Strengths Taste of the Nation South Florida. It'll be at the Lowe's Miami Beach Hotel. And many of South Florida's top chefs are going to be there. I think there's some 60 chefs are going to be there, and you'll be able to taste some of their wonderful foods all in one go. And many thanks to Chef Allen, who once more has been very instrumental in organizing this event. It's an important event and one we should all support. And for more information, go to, now it's a difficult, just get this down, it's nokidhungry.org, South Florida. But go to No Kid Hungry and look for it. It'll be at this Lowe's Hotel, June 17th. And now it's Dinner in Minutes time. So for today's Dinner in Minutes, I thought we'd have a quick summer salad. It's not fried chicken because it's going to be a quick and easy recipe.
Fried chicken can be quick and easy.
Yes, it can. Absolutely.
In minutes?
In minutes. The Hai Vong recipe can't take more than 5-6 minutes.
All right, we'll get back to that, right?
Okay, we'll get back to that recipe. Okay, this is a summer salad. It's a sausage potato salad. It does use a turkey sausage. You can serve it warm or at room temperature, and it tastes even better made the second day, a day ahead, and because the potatoes absorb more of the sauce. So you cut potatoes into small pieces, about a half an inch. Don't peel them, not necessary. Place them in cold water. Cover them with cold water, bring them to a boil, cover with a lid, cook about 15 minutes. And while that's cooking, I use some turkey sausage, but you could use some chicken sausage. Cut into small slices, sauté that. And then I make a dressing, mixing vinegar and mustard together, add a little chicken broth and some oil and chopped onion. And if you don't want to spend time making your own dressing, buy your favorite vinegar and oil dressing and add some chopped onion to it. Toss the dressing with the warm potatoes so the potatoes will absorb the dressing. Add the sausages. Serve with some sliced tomatoes and a warm baguette. Simple and easy. The complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And so please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker, can I guess what we're drinking?
Well, here is a tough question for you. What do you think I'm going to recommend with fried chicken?
I have a feeling it's going to be a little bubbly on my tongue. That's my feeling.
Of course. Bubbly. Now, don't get me wrong. I wouldn't pop a $200 vintage Dom Perignon for fried chicken, but a nice sturdy Spanish cava or Italian bubbly in the $10 range or a $20 California sparkler would be just fine. And this is not just my prejudice. There's actually a logic to it. It's because what I call those scrubbing bubbles in sparkling wine will strip away the fat from your tongue and refresh your palate for the next bite. So it's a matter of, I don't know, physics or chemistry or something.
Or just the fact that you like bubbly?
Well, it doesn't hurt.
And you do know that we actually created our fried chicken event down here called Chicken Coop. And it's a double play on words, thinking that coop is where a chicken lives. But it's really a coop glass that champagne is served in. And we do a dinner over the South Beach Wine and Food Festival. Not a dinner, a walk-around reception, where we have 15 or 20 chefs all doing their take on chicken, many of them featured in Fried and True. And we serve them all with different marks of champagne. And Fred was right. They don't have to be Dom Perignon, although we do serve Dom Perignon and Laurent Perrier and Cristal with the fried chicken. Or it could be a simple cava or sparkling wine. But I couldn't agree more that it makes a lot of sense. And it
Fred,
does take the fat
away. Well, that absolutely
your newest best friend, Fred.
Yes. Yeah. What can be better than the simplest visceral of foods like fried chicken and a sparkling wine or champagne.
Yeah. Now, I'm not the only fan of this, obviously. Harold's Fried Chicken Shack in Chicago is a favorite restaurant of President Obama's, and the Chicago Tribune critics there say that good old sparkling wine is the best match for his signature dish, which is fried chicken and waffles.
But fried chicken and waffles is one dish?
One dish, yeah.
Do you know how fried chicken and waffles got started?
No.
Well, I'm going to tell you very quickly. There's a club up in Harlem called Guilt, G-U-I-L-T, where all the late jazz performers used to go in the 50s and 60s. And the jazz singers couldn't get there. It was too. By the time they got there after their performance, it was too late for dinner and too early for breakfast, and one of them put together waffles and fried chicken because it was an in-between breakfast and dinner, and that's how fried chicken and waffles became a staple, and Frank Sinatra is the one who made it famous.
Oh, there
you
know,
what I'm wondering is, do you order both then? Do you eat both the waffles and the fried chicken?
They come with it. Actually, yes. There are a few recipes in my book, Fried and True, that have a waffle recipe with it.
And I've tasted one recipe from your book.
Asha Gomez, the cardamom from Cardamom Hill in Atlanta. She has an emerald green fried chicken that's sensational.
And it has, there was one with the maple syrup over the fried chicken in the waffle.
Yes, from Brooklyn. And I'm now going to screw up her name, so I'm not going to say it.
Okay, well, anyway, it was very good. Go ahead, Fred, go ahead.
Yeah, well, as Bonnie did, I sort of thought of fried chicken as a Southern dish, and I think it is part of their heritage. But unfortunately, for my taste anyway, Southerners tend to accompany fried chicken with iced tea. And I mean sweetened iced tea.
Sorry, Fred.
And Fred, we know we do have a recipe in Fried and True of a chicken that is brined in a sweet tea brine. Oh. And I have to tell you.
Is it good?
It's delicious.
Of course it's good, Fred.
It wouldn't be in Fried and True. And that recipe came from my friends at Blackberry Farm in Tennessee. They created the recipe for me. They didn't want to give me their classic Blackberry Farms. So they created a sweet tea brined iced chicken, fried chicken, that's really sensational.
And what did they drink with it?
Probably not sweet tea.
In the movie Steel Magnolias, Dolly Parton's character calls sweet tea the house wine of the South.
Absolutely.
So I guess it's kind of inevitable. And when they say sweet, they mean it. I saw a recipe that made an iced tea that was 22% sugar.
Wow.
Which is more sugar than an RC Cola and a moon pie.
Together?
Yeah. Together.
Okay.
And in the southern city of Atlanta, I once had fried chicken, fried green tomatoes, and cornbread at Aunt Pity Pat's Porch.
Oh, it's delicious.
The restaurant
in the
film Gone with the Wind, named after Melanie's aunt.
Right.
And the wine list there was kind of limited, so I had a drink they called Sweet Peach. And it was peach-flavored vodka mixed with, you guessed it, highly sweetened iced tea.
Hmm. Wish okay. we had
at least
some.
It had a little wallop to it. Now, Lee's book mentions the great fried chicken at the French Laundry in California's wine country. And as Linda mentioned, the meal there is $300 or more, so I figure you'd want to have something equally expensive from its wine list, so you could order a bottle of 1996 Krug champagne for $6,000. Or, as Lee mentioned, you could have it with Dom Perignon. I guess it's got to be okay that way.
Which looks good next to $6,000.
Yes, but anyway, if you want to stay solvent, take my advice and have a nice, inexpensive sparkling wine with your fried chicken.
Okay.
So he wants to know what Fred wants. What do you drink with your fried chicken?
I love rosé champagne, and I have to say that I oftentimes drink Laurent Perrier rosé champagne. Although recently I've been on book tour and I've been drinking a lot of Lisa Vanderpump's. The Real Housewife of L.A. has a great new sangria out.
Oh yes.
And I'll tell you, it happens to be quite good. So, but champagne is my drink of choice.
Now, do you think something with a little sweetness does go with the fried chicken because it has the sweetness of the fat?
I think so. I think it complements it. I think it cuts it and it complements it at the same time.
And can Lee tell us his dinner in minutes recipe for fried chicken?
Oh, the Hai Vong one?
No, he wants.
No,
yeah.
He said he had a quick one.
Yeah, you have
a quick recipe?
Yeah,
well, fried chicken's the easiest thing in the world. People make it harder than it is. It's as simple as having chicken. And another tip is to use chicken that's cold. Take it from the refrigerator that's kind of chilled already, because you'll find that the crust sticks better to it.
Chicken pieces, you mean?
Chicken pieces.
Right,
so
okay.
Have a chicken that's cut up. Have a self-rising flour. Have an egg bath. Take chicken. Dip it in the egg bath. Dip it in the flour. Put it in oil that's 370 degrees and cook it for 10 to 12 minutes, and voila, you have a sensational fried and true chicken dinner.
There you go. Okay. Mm. But he uses self-raising flour. That's interesting that he does that. And, you know, we only have half a minute left, but in your book you have sides as well. And I was amazed with your hash brown casserole. Big surprise, you use refrigerated shredded potatoes and a can of cream of chicken soup. Sounds a little bit like the 1950s.
It's a little white trashy, but delicious. And our tomato pie also
white
has...
White trashy, okay.
Yeah, and our tomato pie that's also in the book has Ritz crackers in it. So, you know what? It's from all ends of the planet. Fried chicken can, hoity-toity or the simplest of recipes are in fried.
Boy, this is real American food.
This is Americana food.
Real Scottish food.
That's right. Served with haggis.
Okay. Well, this has been really a tasty week. Lee Schwager, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here, Bonnie. Good to talk to you, Fred and Linda. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Okay. His book is Fried and True, More Than 50 Recipes for America's Best Fried Chicken and Sides. And believe me, the pictures of the sides are just fabulous. It's a fascinating book to read and a delicious one to experience. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Bonnie Berman, great to be with you.
Yes, likewise. Thank
you. And wishing Joe well. Wishing him to come back soon, Joe. Next week, we're going to be talking with the author of The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And along with Dr. Neil Bernard, he's an adjunct associate professor of medicine at Georgetown University's Schools of Medicine. So it should be an interesting program. It's going to be 1 hour long.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And we thank you for spending your time with us today. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction and production assistance from our online producer, Paul Leary. We do have free audio archives, downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. You can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. Tomorrow at this time, please join Ed Bell for another edition of South Florida Arts Beat. And we return on Monday with a look at how our unconscious mind rules our behavior. Bonnie Berman joining you, sending best wishes along with Linda to Joseph Cooper for a speedy recovery. Hoping your day and weekend are great. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.